and to Sardis, and to Philadelphia, and to Laodicea. Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the seven lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were like white wool, as white as snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined in a furnace, and his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand, he held seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead, but he laid his right hand on me, saying, "Fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and Hades. Write, therefore, the things that you have seen, those that are and those that are to take place after this. As for the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and the seven gold lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches." Okay, now with that, we have the ending of chapter 1, the introduction of the first of the seven cycles of visions that are recorded in the book. And I want to go back and start with verse 11. And the author here says that he hears a voice behind me. Now, this is another example of the many, many places in the apocalypse where phrases and terms that are really pregnant with meaning to the Hebraic Christian, the Jewish Christian of the first century, they're virtually lost on the reader in the 21st century. Now, that phrase, behind me, it actually has roots in rabbinic Judaism. And specifically, if you go to a public library or university library and you find a Jewish encyclopedia and you look up the term, maybe it would be better for me to write it down here. You look up the term bat kol, that is transliterated this way, B-A-T-K-O-L, bat kol, you'll find an interesting little entry in the Jewish encyclopedia on that term. And it literally means the daughter of the voice. The daughter of the voice. And in the Talmudic tradition, does everybody know what the Talmud is? The Talmud is the collection of ancient Jewish writings that are really the commentary on the Old Testament and the Jewish traditions. And the Pharisees and the scribes that Jesus contended with, most of these men, as are most rabbis and Jewish scholars today, their scholarship is focused primarily on the Talmud and other traditional writings, not so much the scriptures themselves, although obviously they do know those, but it would be impossible for a Jew to conceive of what we call the Old Testament without the Talmud to go along with it, to understand it and interpret it. And in the Talmud and in the literature associated with it, then as now, this term referred to a divine voice that a prophet would hear that gave him guidance and pronouncements to share with the people. And this is typically the way you find it written up in this kind of literature. It's heard from behind the prophet. And the fact that the voice was like a trumpet indicates that the power and authority and the moral authority of the one speaking. Now, you notice here on the board, I've got a bunch of scripture passages that we will, Lord willing, get to, but I've got in red a very important question. What is this book about? And that is a question that everyone has to bring to this book. I mean, we bring that question on a larger scale to the Bible as a whole, but to the book of Revelation in particular. And how you answer that question and what your expectations are about how you answer the question is going to determine largely what you come away from a study of this book in terms of what it means and how it applies. And I think that it won't be any big news to you here today when I tell you that most people, when they ask that question, they're already somewhat front-loaded to have the idea that its main relevance is to our immediate future. I mean, that's the standard evangelical, Bible-believing approach to this book. And whatever past relevance it had is limited perhaps to these seven churches that we're about to study. But that's about it, because from there on out, it talks about what's going on in modern times and all of this sort of thing. But I hope that you are seeing that that is a completely incorrect way to approach this book. And this is a perfect example. What in the world does Jerry Falwell know about Bot Call? Probably nothing. Or Tim LaHaye, for that matter. They don't care about these things, because it doesn't suit their approach to the book. But I can tell you, if you were a Jewish Christian, one of the original readers and hearers of the book, it would have meant a great deal to you. And black helicopters and all kind of lurid stories about Antichrist would have not meant a whole lot. Now, in verse 11, we read this command, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and to Laodicea. Now, John here is next instructed, write what you see in a book. This is a command. It's an imperative statement. Now, what do you think that means? Why do you think that's important? There's a very important signal being sent in that command. John, the author, is making sure that his readers and hearers understand something when he says that, when he writes that. What do you think it is? Well, that could be. That's not exactly what I was looking for, but that's a very important point. Yes. Precisely. He's being told to write. This isn't something that he's cooking up. He didn't take some funny cough medicine and start hallucinating and seeing these kind of visions. He's being told to do this, and our understanding is it's the risen Christ who's telling him to do it. The visions do not originate with him. He is commanded to write these things. And another component of this command is that it's yet another indicator of the Hebraic character of the book. Just as Yahweh, the Lord, commanded the prophets of old to proclaim what he told them to the people, John stands in the same tradition. You go tell the people, God says to the prophets, now that becomes write and send this to the churches in the New Covenant era. But you see, you've got a lot of similarity there. In verse 12, he says, then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning, I saw seven golden lampstands. Now that's sort of an unusual way to respond to hear to a voice from the human perspective. How can you turn and see a voice? Well, as unusual as it may be, this was a common way of responding to the voice of God. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 18, the voice of Yahweh is personified. It's given sort of a visible, tangible, something you could see in thunder and lightning and the sounding of trumpets. Here, John turns to see the voice, but what does he see when he turns? He sees seven golden lampstands. Does anybody here have the old King James Version? Okay, would you read what it says there about he turns and sees seven what? Okay. Okay. What's the problem with that? This is why modern translations are very helpful. It's far more practical and historical than that. Candles weren't invented until the Middle Ages. Our King James translators, for all of their brilliance, apparently didn't stop to think that there were no candles back then. They had oil lamps. That's why it literally says lampstand. It doesn't say candlestick. Now, you walk into a big Anglican church from which most of the King James translators were a part of back in the 1600s, you saw candles. But there were no candles back then when John wrote the book of Revelation. So that's why almost, doesn't the New King James say lampstands? Yeah, and see, the New King James, it set out to stay as close to the old King James as possible, but even they changed that because they recognized that was really kind of a major mistake on the King James translator's part. And I do want you to turn to Zechariah chapter 4, verse 2. Because John is drawing on the language from this Old Testament prophetic book. Zechariah chapter 4, verse 2. And whoever finds it first can read it. You got it, Don? How did you get it so fast? Oh, that's right, I got it written up there. That's no fair. Okay. Go ahead, Don. Now, the meaning of the lampstand symbol, and John is bringing it over from Zechariah, from Zechariah to his writing. The meaning of this has been variously interpreted to mean either the presence of the Lord with his people, or the nation of Israel shining as a light to the pagan nations of the world, bearing witness to the truth and the Spirit of God. In the apocalypse, the lampstands become the symbols of the seven churches. Now, how do we know that? Yeah. It says so. You know, very often, we say the Bible is its own best interpreter, and when the Bible clearly makes a statement, it clearly tells us something, we better pay attention to it. Now, this would be a good place for me to give you the next handout that I want to hand to you, and this is by way of simply reinforcing what I've been saying all along in this. And by the way, the handouts that I've given so far, I still have copies from last week and the several other handouts. If each of you would take one of these and pass it back. This is just a simple grouping of the time statements, the time indicators in the book that you can have to show you how this book constantly, in really very significant places, tells the reader what you're reading is about to take place. And I should qualify that by saying the original reader, because as I have gone at great lengths, both in this class and when I preached the sermon series on Revelation 4 or 5 years ago, the term and the phrase soon, quickly, is emptied of all possible meaning if we stretch it out thousands of years. That doesn't mean soon. So the Bible gives us interpretive keys in many places about how to understand these things. As you're seeing with, say, finding out something like the term bot call, sometimes you have to dig deeper. And if you're going to really come to terms with this book, you have to dig very deep because it's a deep book. So the symbols, the symbolism of the seven lampstands are interpreted for us, and we're told they're symbols of the seven churches. And furthermore, the presence of the Son of Man there becomes a symbol for his presence among the churches. And in Zechariah, the lampstands are somehow symbolic of Israel, and so the seven churches become symbolic of the new Israel, you see. Now, in verses 13 to 16, in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man, and there's this detailed description of what he looked like. Now, the imagery in the vision, let me just read it to you very quickly again, because it's very striking. And again, when you read something like this, it takes us back to this first question, the question I've got here in red. What is this book about? One like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden girdle around his breast. Now, right away, you have to ask yourself, what is that? Why is he clothed this way? That really doesn't mean anything to us. I mean, if we start reading this, and I don't know what image it conjures in your mind, but to the people who originally read this, it would have conjured either a kingly attire or, more commonly, a priestly attire. And it's more likely that this is indicating the priestly authority of Jesus, because he's already used this lampstand imagery that sort of takes us back to the environment of the temple. That's where the Jew would have commonly seen, or the Christian would have commonly seen, lamps burning in some godly fashion in the temple where God's presence was. And his head and his hair were white as wool. Well, does that mean Jesus is prematurely aged here? You know, what is that supposed to mean? His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined as in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of many waters. He held seven stars. His mouth issued a sharp two-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in full strength. Now, the imagery becomes progressively more dramatic and striking. And so we, the modern readers of the Apocalypse, would do well to heed the counsel of in this case, I'm going to quote G.B. Caird, who is or was one of the great English-speaking New Testament scholars of the 20th century. And this is what he said about this passage. He said, this is not photographic art. This is not photographic art. His aim, the author's aim, is to set the echoes of memory and association ringing. So Caird underlines the continuing importance of audience relevance. Whose memories and whose associations are meant to be stimulated by this kind of imagery? the people who were originally reading it. And judging from what he's talking about here, they weren't Buddhists, they weren't Hindus, they weren't Muslims. They were Jews who had come to follow Jesus as the Messiah, the majority of them. And whatever Gentiles at this stage who had come to follow Jesus would have come under the auspices of churches that were largely dominated by Jewish followers of Jesus. They were the primary recipients of the words written by John. Their memories would have been perhaps sparked to recall the words of the prophet Daniel. Now turn to Daniel chapter 10, verses 5 to 6. Daniel 10, 5 to 6. And if I could call on a few other people to be ready to read in the interest of time. Let's see, Sam Ogden, would you read Exodus 27, 20 to 21, if you'd look that up. And just to keep the continuity of being going, I'll be using that term in my sermon, so it's on my mind today. Sam Starrett, if you would read Leviticus 24, 2 to 4. You do have your Bible, don't you, Sam? Yes, okay. All right, Daniel 10, 5 to 6. I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with the gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sounds of his words like the noise of a multitude. There's no doubt this is the language that John is drawing on. He's taking this out of the Old Testament books that he's most familiar with and that his hearers and readers would have been familiar with. In verse 15, Christ is formally here introduced as the revealer of the visions. He's seen in the midst of the lampstands, and that's a metaphorical communication of his present identification with the suffering church. You remember we talked last time. John said he was a partner with these Christians in what? In the great tribulation, in the tribulation. There was tribulation going on, a tribulation that Jesus himself had predicted would take place in that generation. And with the imagery, these verses are also, we find a recurring theme, the theme of light. Now, the Old Testament roots of this imagery can be found, for example, in Exodus 27, 20 to 21. So light, God is ordering that light be associated with his worship. And then in Leviticus 24, 2 to 4, Sam, Starrett. Okay, that's good. You see, you got the same injunction. The light must burn continually. Now, in John 1, 5 to 9, words that are probably among the most familiar in the Bible, from the Gospel of John, the same author, according to most folks who writes the book of Revelation, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. John the Baptist was not the light, but came to bear witness to the light. The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world. And then Paul, in 1 Timothy 6, calls on the same imagery in a striking doxological statement. Now somebody tell me, what is a doxological statement? Has nothing to do with ducks and dogs, by the way. Well, okay, Sam. Yeah, we sing the doxology, praise God from whom all blessings flow. A doxological statement is a statement of praise, and in 1 Timothy 6, 15 to 16, he says, "And this will be made manifest at the proper time by the blessed and only sovereign, the King of kings and Lord of lords, who alone has immortality and dwells in unapproachable light." It's interesting, isn't it, that there's this recurring theme of the imagery of God being associated with divine light. How many of us, when we think about God, when we try to conceptualize God and being near to God, we do that in terms of light? But that's the language the Bible uses. And the description of the Lord's attire, as I said, it has sort of a dual function. It would call to mind, for example, his priestly ministry, his priestly office, his kingly ministry as the risen king. And in terms of the head and hair references, let me just mention these if you want to jot these down. I'm not sure that, I don't think that I put them on the board. The eyes and feet and head and hair references, Daniel 7 verse 9 and Daniel 10 verse 6, we just read some of that, and Ezekiel 1:7. Daniel 7:9, Daniel 10:6, and Ezekiel 1:7, you find almost the same language that John is using here to describe the Son of Man from those books. Now there's another often overlooked element to this fire and light imagery, especially as it relates to the Son of God. The reference to burnished bronze and to the refiner's fire, that has very deep roots in the judgment imagery motifs of the Bible. For example, turn to Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13, and let's look together at verses 34 to 40. Jesus here in Matthew's gospel is making a statement about this, and he's drawing on this same imagery. It's not identical to this, but it's in the same ballpark of drawing on this fire and purging and burnishing and refining type imagery. But I want you to notice what it's associated with, because there is a connection here, a very direct connection with what the book of Revelation is all about. Matthew 13, 34 to 40. And for the sake of those listening by way of CD, I will read this so there won't be long gaps on the CD and they won't be able to hear what you're doing. All this Jesus said to the crowds in parables. Indeed, he said nothing to them without a parable. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet, "I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter what has been hidden since the foundation of the world." Then he left the crowds and went into the house. And his disciples came to him saying, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field." And he answered, "He who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed means the sons of the kingdom. The weeds are the sons of the evil one." Now let me ask you a question. Let me just stop right there. Somebody tell me, to whom did our Lord Jesus ever say, "You are of your father, the devil"? Excuse me? To the leaders of the Jews, to the official spokesman of the leaders of the Jews. And here he's saying, "Sons of the evil one, you are of your father the devil." You see, there's a connection here. And verse 39, "The enemy who sowed them is the devil, and the harvest," notice, "the harvest is the close of the age, and the reapers are the angels." Angels means messengers, those who are sent. It doesn't necessarily mean, and in this case probably doesn't mean, little creatures with wings flapping around and all that sort of thing. Verse 40, "Just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so will it be at the close of the age." And you see, here again, we've got a time reference. Jesus is speaking to people. What in the world does this mean? If he's talking about something that's going to happen 10,000 years from the time he's... It means nothing to these people. Why would he even say it? Yes. Excuse me? Well, in my translation, it says close of the age, but at this age makes it even more relevant to that time period. And you note that the close of the age is associated with what? Judgment, burning with fire. And in this instance, it's the pictures of the burning of weeds from a field. And the importance of the issue is that statement, close of the age or this age. Now, the Greek indicates that the closing or the ending of an era or an epoch, it's not the dissolution of the cosmos or the destruction of the entire universe. And what era, what epoch is coming to an end? Somebody, tell me. How did they know that? How would they know that the old covenant era was coming to an end? Jim? Well, he was telling them, but the very fact that Jesus was there was the main sign. The Messiah has come. This is what begins the transformation, the transition. The letter to the Hebrews provides a more even direct answer. If you'll turn to Hebrews 9, verse 26. Hebrews 9, 26. In comparing the sacrificial death of Christ to the older covenant sacrificial system, that's what the book of Hebrews really is all about. We had this old way of doing all of this that served our fathers well, but now something has come to replace it. Something has come to transform it, to change it, to make it better, to make it so we don't have to keep doing all this over and over again. And notice what he says here in 9:26, "For then he would have to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared, the Messiah has appeared once for all. When does he appear? At the end of the ages, to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Now, I don't know how much more plain it can be made. But the appearance of the Messiah, that's the sign that the age is coming to an end. What age? The Old Covenant age, the Jewish era, the dominance of national ethnic Israel as it had existed in that form, that time is coming to a close. A new Israel is coming into being that's going to transcend national boundaries and racial distinctions and sexual roles and all of these kind of things. Bob, did you have a question? Were you, okay. Thus, the entirety of the Messiah's coming is associated with the larger and total work of his redemption of the world, as seen not only in his atoning sacrifice for sin. Now, that's what when we normally think about Jesus and his coming, this is what we almost always sort of associate it with and limit it to. He went to the cross, he gave his life for sinners, he rose again on the third day, he ascended into heaven. Now, I don't mean to minimize the importance of that. I mean, that is the central focus of our Reformed Protestant theology, and even Roman Catholic theology and Orthodox theology for that matter. But, and if you remember the quote that I read to you from Dr. Sproul about his having read this book, The Parousia, he said that he could never read the New Testament again in the same way after having read this book. Now, I happen to have an audio tape where he was talking about this very subject of having read this book, and he was speaking to a gathering of very prominent Reformed New Testament scholars. This was back in the early 90s. And he told them that until the church begins to really take into account the central significance of the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, we really haven't fully grasped everything the New Testament is talking about. Now, this isn't some marginalized guy sitting up at night with his own little tapes and books coming up with this. This is R.C. Sproul, a very well-respected Bible scholar and theologian, making this statement. So what I'm saying is, and the larger point that I want you to grasp from this, is that there is some connection. There is perhaps a very important connection, a great connection, when we think about the work of Jesus as the Messiah, that goes beyond and isn't limited to what he did on the cross. And again, I don't minimize that. That is the central thing, but we have to include with that his actions as the judge and avenger of his people. Because in a very real sense, if the temple at Jerusalem had not been destroyed, the Old Covenant era would have never come to an end. To have lived in the era or the epoch from the time of the resurrection to the ascension to the time of the annihilation of national Israel was to live in the time of the end of the ages. Now, it's significant when you study the history of the Roman siege against Jerusalem. You start seeing all of these incredible connections. Now, where was it that Jesus made his most famous prediction, or the main prediction, about the destruction of Jerusalem? Where do we read about that? Yeah, come on, the people in the city are waiting. They're waiting to hear. Physically, where was he located when he gave that prophecy, that statement? The Mount of Olives. That's why it's called the Olivet Discourse. Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. Interestingly enough, you come to John's Gospel, you don't find it there. As I've told you before, I believe the entire book of Revelation is John's version in a far more panoramic, technicolor edition of what Jesus said to the other apostles on the Mount of Olives. But the Mount of Olives is the place that Jesus gives forth this proclamation of the coming destruction of Israel, and specifically the temple and the leadership of Israel in AD 70, when it actually took place. It was more of a progressive thing, and at a certain point we'll be spending more time talking about the details of that, because as I said, it's absolutely incredible when you start looking at some of these connections. Now, the siege and ultimate destruction of Jerusalem really was a process that started in AD 66 under the Roman general Vespasian. He didn't finish the job. The Jews had revolted. Nero had decided he'd had enough of these people. It was time to kind of close the curtain on the Jews. He sent Vespasian to do the job. Nero wound up committing suicide. Vespasian was called back to Rome, where he was elected emperor. And so he sent his son Titus to finish the job, which Titus did in AD 70. So you got about a four-year period, 4.5 years roughly. Titus, the general, posted the 10th Legion that would be one of the main armies that went into Jerusalem to absolutely destroy the place. Guess where they were posted? The Mount of Olives. Isn't that interesting? Now, there is another thing here that, following off the symbolism that Jesus was talking about in Matthew 13 about things being cut down and thrown into the fire as a symbol of destruction, there's a very well-known story among the Jews and in Jewish tradition behind the symbolism of the tree, of a tree being cut down and destroyed. Israel knew the precise meaning of that kind of a statement, and from its early beginning, each family would plant a tree to represent a son born to that family among the Jews. And when the son rebelled against the rule of his father, guess what? The tree was cut down and destroyed, and the son was cast out. If you read the Gospels carefully, you find, the very well-known, I think we talked about it last week, the parable of the owner of the vineyard. He sends his son, and they kill the son. And so he has the vine dressers cast out, the vine dressers are destroyed. Jesus told the Pharisees on more than a few occasions, the kingdom will be taken from the proper inheritors of it, the sons, and given to someone else who will appreciate it. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. Now, another thing that you really need to get a handle on to appreciate what we're talking about here is this concept of progressive judgment that God brings against pagans and against his own people. You know, we're talking about these books where we find this language being drawn from in Zechariah and Daniel. What was going on among the Israelites when those books were being written? When those prophecies were being sent for? What's going on in the life of Israel and Judah in the times when Daniel's prophecy had been given and his book was written and that of Zechariah and Joel and all these great prophets of the Old Testament? Yeah, they were in captivity. What was the reason for that? God's judgment. Now, God just didn't have a bad day one morning and get up and say, I think, well, I'm going to have the Babylonians come in and carry the people off into captivity and destroy Jerusalem. No, it was a progressive building up to, as I have here, sort of a climactic crescendo of judgment once the people had sort of, and you'll see where I'm drawing the language, filled the cup to the brim of judgment to be poured out upon them. Let me just sort of give you a panoramic view of this, and some of these we'll turn and look at. In Genesis 3, 1 to 16, Adam and Eve are in the garden, and after each of them rebelled against God's rule, the Lord comes and he walks in the garden, and judgment is handled in such a way to produce repentance. And when the repentance is made, and only the way that the first man knew to make it, then the judgment is passed. You're going to be cast out of the garden. This will happen. This will happen. And you jump over to Genesis 6. What's happening in Genesis 6? Noah, the flood. The Lord comes to the earth and he talks to Noah and he tells him that the whole earth has become wicked, and he further reveals his plans for judgment upon the wicked, and because of Noah's righteousness, God advises Noah to build an ark. And the floodwaters come and the judgment begins. The righteous were spared. And then you jump over to Genesis 18. The Lord visits Abraham and he comes to visit him for two reasons. He's come to tell him that Abraham and Sarah are going to bear a son, but he's coming to tell him about something else. Somebody tell me what that is. What's the other thing that he comes to tell Abraham? About the impending doom of Sodom and Gomorrah. And later on, Lot would be told by the angels to get out of the city. And the righteous were spared, and the wicked received God's judgment. And then in Exodus chapter 8, 1 to 8, this should be fresh in our minds, God comes to Moses and says, I've come to deliver the people from Egypt, and he sends Moses into Egypt to warn them of their wickedness and to beg for the release of the Hebrews, and the Egyptians resist Moses, and God's judgment comes against them, and again, the righteous are not judged. But when they later become wicked, as we will see very soon now in our study, once we get beyond the Ten Commandments, when the Israelites become wicked and they rebel against God's rule, they will suffer God's judgment. And then in Isaiah, this is another great prophet of the exile and the return as a result of the judgment. In Isaiah chapter 19, verse 1. Well, let's look at that passage. Turn to Isaiah 19, verse 1. This would be a good one to focus in on because of the language. And there are several passages here in Isaiah that we can look at together. In Isaiah chapter 19, verse 1, you again see the judgment of God, and it's using celestial cloud imagery. Behold, the Lord is riding on a cloud, and He is about to come down to Egypt. Egypt was ripe for judgment, and the Lord came, and the righteous were spared, but the wicked were judged. Now look over at, turn back to Isaiah 10. Isaiah chapter 10, verses 5 to 10. Isaiah chapter 10, verses 5 to 10. Now let me ask somebody to read that passage, please, and read it as loud as you can. Well, maybe not as loud as you can, but louder than if you were just reading to the person next to you. Somebody, please. Isaiah 5, okay. Tom Rothermill? Okay, that's good. Let's stop right there. Who is this judgment against? Okay. But he says, woe to who? Well, let me turn to it. I think the judgment is against apostate Israel. Maybe I've given you the wrong passage, but let's take another look at it. Isaiah 10, 5 to 10. Woe to those who decree iniquitous decrees, and the writers who keep writing oppression, to turn aside the needy from justice, and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be their spoil, and that they may make the fatherless their prey. What will you do on the day of punishment and the ruin that will come from afar? To whom would you flee for help? Well, you see, those words are being spoken against Israel. And then in Isaiah 13, he tells of yet another judgment. The Lord comes in verses 6 and 9, and the judgment is pronounced against Babylon. In Joel 2, verse 1, describes the Lord coming against Judah. And once again, it's bringing judgment upon apostate believers who've turned away. In Jeremiah 2, 25, you find the same thing. In Daniel 5, 28, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Daniel 9, yet another judgment against apostate Israel, which foretells the judgment that we've been reading about in Revelation 1:15. But now I want you to turn to Matthew 16, and this will be the last thing that we focus on this morning. Matthew 16, verses 27 and 28. And we read there, "For the Son of Man is going to come with the angels in the glory of His Father, then He will repay each person according to what He's done. Truly I say to you, there's some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom." Now, in the Greek, "for the Son of Man is going to come," in the Greek, it's the Greek word "mello." That's a very strategic word because it carries with it the idea of absolute immediacy. As a matter of fact, if you have access to Young's literal translation of the Bible, Young's literal translation has it, "And the Son of Man is about to come." That's really what the word means in most contexts. It's about to happen. It's right at the door. The Son of Man is about to come. There's an ultimacy and an immediacy about it. And so what is this book about then? What is the book of Revelation telling us? I can't hear you. Come on. The wrath of God is coming against those who are rebelling against Him, and they are committing the ultimate act of rebellion. They are rejecting the new covenant. They are rejecting the Messiah that He has sent.